This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
Santa baby, slip a sable under the tree.
Pink Martini, a 12-piece pop orchestra, is best known around the country for its retro style. Co-founder Thomas Lauderdale says it best. If the United Nations had a house band, Pink Martini would be it. This season, Pink Martini took on a new challenge, creating a holiday album. And the orchestra did it in true, hard-to-categorize Pink Martini style. We invited Thomas Lauderdale and lead singer China Forbes to talk about the group's early years in Cambridge.
Thomas and I were at Harvard together. We were in the same class, and we both chose the same dorm as our sophomore dorm, which was Adams House, and it was the artsy house. And Thomas went on to throw fabulous parties there, and I went on to do a lot of musical theater while at Harvard. And so we knew who each other was, and we broke into the lower common room late at night and practiced all of the songs we had always wanted to work on, like Verdi arias and Barbara Streisand's The Way We Were. And Thomas was my enthusiastic accompanist, and so, it was just a way that we bonded.
So during those undergrad years, you spent a lot of the time singing or performing down in the basement at Adams House.
Yeah, but we weren't performing because there was no audience. It was just like
you're just having a lot
night,
of fun.
3 a.m. rehearsals. Yeah.
Now, at that point, did you see sort of the seeds of a band, or did that just feel like a lot of fun that gave you a break during college?
Well, I never saw the seeds of a band. Thomas was a classical pianist, but I don't know what he saw.
Yeah, no, I never thought that I would ever be in a band. I thought I was actually going to go into politics or maybe classical piano, but certainly the thought of being in a band never crossed my mind.
So what made you think of it?
The band?
Yeah.
Well, that happened a couple of years later. I was back in Portland, and I was going to political fundraisers and hated the bands that were playing, and there was a really terrible attempt to illegalize homosexuality in the state of Oregon, and I organized sort of a concert in opposition to this and needed an opening band for the Del Rubio triplets, three gals, three guitars, and so threw on a cocktail dress and started the band. A couple years later, I wondered where China Forbes was in the world.
So you had a band and you thought, I want her to be in it.
Yeah, I wanted her to be the singer. And so I found out that she was in New York and tricked her into flying to Portland.
Tricked me with huge sums of cash. The oldest trick in the book.
Now, China, let me go back to you
great.
For a minute, because both of you went to Harvard, although, China, you actually grew up in Cambridge. In
yes.
fact, your parents met when they were working at GBH.
I grew up in the theater because my parents met at WGBH, and then they went on to work at the Theater Company of Boston with you know, everyone from Al Pacino to Stocker Channing, who were, you know, early in their careers. And I just grew up in theaters. And my sister, who was a few years older, was even an actress in many of the plays and musicals. And I got to be her understudy one night when she went to a slumber party. So I made my debut at age 4 in Arturo Uy with Al Pacino. So it was just a really creative home life that we had.
And then, Thomas, when you went back to Portland, Oregon after college at Harvard, as you were saying, the band got started with this very oddball niche, which is that you started to feel like political fundraisers had pretty lame music. You know, you were an
right.
aspiring politician at the time. And you thought, yeah. I'm going to create better soundtracks for political fundraisers with a focus on progressive causes. Is that right?
Right. That's right. That's right. And we also, you know, funded ourselves by playing sort of several weddings along the way. So it was a combination
weddings
of,
that ended in divorce.
Yeah. We've got a 95% divorce rate.
So, China, when you made that move from yeah. New York, sort of Cambridge, Boston to the West Coast, it truly did bring you to a different music scene. You found a very different environment.
Yes, because I was, you know, schlepping my guitar and my amp around New York City in taxi cabs playing in rock clubs. And then I started singing with Pink Martini in a totally different style from what I was doing in New York. And it was this sort of retro, romantic Hollywood Rita Hayworth thing that was happening. And it was great.
The sun has left and forgotten me. It's dark, I cannot see. Why does this rain pour down? I'm gonna drown in a sea. Deep confusion.
Pink Martini has grown to be 12 musicians. You describe yourself as a pop orchestra, you know, a little vintage, a little campy, a little Liberace sometimes. Do you think that's a fair way to describe it?
Well, that's what other people say. I don't think Thomas likes the Liberace.
I always get scared that I'm becoming a little bit too much like Liberace sometimes.
It's a slippery slope of sequence.
Too many glissandos.
Just don't bedazzle your jackets and you'll be fine.
So you've built this reputation as a band as being really eclectic, really diverse. You know, as you said, rumbas and sambas to French 1930s pieces to, as someone wrote, a sort of an urban musical travelogue. You know, you dig around through old music, you find something interesting that's old and kind of make it new again with your signature. But this interesting thing about your sixth album is that you did a holiday album, which at first on the surface seems so different than everything you've done before. It seems so traditional. So what made you think we're going to try holiday?
Starbucks. Starbucks really was the clincher. Like I had vowed actually never to do a holiday album.
But all vows are made to be broken.
Yes, and this was certainly one. And since, you know, I've grown up loving holiday music, I think, and it was just another opportunity to explore the terrain of holiday music in a very sort of inclusive way. So.
But, you know, Starbucks was our first distributor. When we made our first album, they were the ones who sold it all over Portland.
They were the first to sell Sympatique.
And
they sold like
they've been very supportive of us. Yeah. And, you know, as Thomas says, they're the last distributor of music really in the country. And they had asked us to do songs in the past for their holiday compilations, like Little Drummer Boy we did. And
Do You Hear What I Hear?
And so this year they said, why don't you do a full-length album? And so it was this great assignment.
And the album certainly has some classics. I'm thinking about Irving Berlin's White Christmas. But maybe, predictably, you put your signature stamp on them. You took classics and made them different. Let's listen to one of them. And actually, let's listen at first to that classic Irving Berlin song. And again, this is one that somehow you still put the Pink Martini stamp on. So let's listen to that.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear.
You know, with a piece like White Christmas, the song is so perfect and so beautiful, and it doesn't really need anything other than just really the sound of the voice. I think that this version of White Christmas is a stripped-down version which exposes the inner beauty of both the lyric of the verse, which sort of is rarely sung.
You kept it
simple. Keep it really simple. And then it shifts and turns into a Japanese version of White Christmas.
Right, so let's hear that. Yuki. That's part two, exactly. So let's hear that Japanese version, which is very unlike the tradition. Classic that you put on the album is Do You Hear What I Hear? Let's listen to a portion of that too.
Said the night wind to the little lamb, do you see what I see? Way up in the sky, little lamb, do you see what I see? A star dancing in the night, with a tail as big as a kite, with a tail as big as a kite.
China, when you were singing that, or when you set out to sing that, how did you decide you're going to put your specific unique voice on it? What did you want to bring to it?
A sort of mystery, you know. I mean, it's this mysterious building of, like, do you see what I see? Do you hear what I hear? What is it? You know, this elusive thing called peace, you know. And Thomas had told me the story of how this song was written as a response to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which just added yet another political element to these songs that you would not expect. I think Thomas has a way of finding the politics in every piece of music.
That certainly brings us back to the roots of the band. You know, when you decided that you were going to do this for political fundraisers and make soundtracks that had for progressive causes, I mean, you found a way, even in your holiday album, to do that.
but kind
subtly.
Of by accident.
By accident. Was, yeah. was it like, let's find the most controversial songs we can with the craziest backstories? Like, for example, right. You know.
They were all accidents.
It was totally accidental. You know, even a song like Carol of the Bells, right, which was actually, you know, dun-da-da-dum-bum-ba-da-dum, written in 1916 by Mikhail Leontovich. I thought, this is great. We'll just go back to the original Ukrainian lyrics and restore them and perform with the Pacific Youth Choir.
We have that one. Let's hear a piece of that, too. As you said, it's the Ukrainian Bell Carol.
Politics behind this one, it's really amazing. It was composed by a choir master named Mikhail Leontovich in 1916, and he composed hundreds of pieces, but this piece was really popular from the very beginning, and then, of course, brought to the States and recorded as Carol of the Bells. The thing was, it was the composer was murdered about 5 years later in his parents' home for his participation in the short-lived Ukrainian Revolution. He was murdered by Russian agents.
So the backstories of some of these songs are pretty heavy.
But you know, the thing is, like, they're so beautiful. And it's maybe even better not to know any of the backstory.
Just enjoy the beautiful music.
Yeah.
One more piece, an interesting one, is Osho Kantalikas. This is the song written in an ancient Sephardic language called Ladino. It's only spoken in a few parts of the world. And you've syncopated it to give it maybe a funkier beat than it might otherwise have. Let's hear part of that one.
Hanukkah linda sta aquí, ocho candelas para mí. Hanukkah linda sta aquí, ocho candelas para mí. Oh, una candelica, dos candelicas, tres candelicas, cuatro candelicas.
That, of course, is a familiar NPR voice. That's Ari Shapiro, who grew up in Portland. Is that right, Thomas?
And, that's
and,
right.
And occasionally sings with Pink Martini.
Ocho candelas para mí.
China Forbes and Thomas Lauderdale, thank you very much for coming on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
You're
welcome. Pink Martini's new holiday CD is called Joy to the World. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Merry Christmas, and join us again next week for more Radio Boston.